ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dead on the air. We're dead on the air.
Good morning and welcome to Dads on the Air. We thank you for joining us today and hope you'll enjoy the program we have for you this week. We also like to welcome all our listeners who are tuned into the show on the internet via the live streaming coming to you from our studio here at 2GLF in Sydney, Australia, especially those in the US of A, Canada and the UK. My name's Peter Vandervoort and today we present a compelling interview with a separated Australian mother whose ex-husband successfully resorted to all the malicious tools available to both parents in the family justice system. Interestingly, mostly used by mothers in order to separate fathers from their children. Diana, not her real name because we're prevented by law from using her real name, describes in great detail how her ex-husband was able to use false child sex abuse allegations and take out an AVO against her in order to separate her from her children, safe in the knowledge he would not be punished as a result. Our Prime Minister made it known in no uncertain terms recently that he regards, and I quote, those that trade on the tragedy of others should rot in jail and in fact should rot in hell, unquote. In his view, those that do so, quote, are engaged in the world's most evil trade and represent the absolute scum of the earth, the lowest form of life, unquote. Well, Mr. Rudd, we have a whole industry trading on the tragedy of others, who have done so with the blessing of successive Australian governments for the past 35 years. This industry has wreaked absolute havoc and destroyed millions of lives during their long reign of terror on separated parents and their children. Yet, hardly a whisper of concern is raised by our legislators. Today's program exemplifies much of what is wrong with the family justice system and raises a lot of questions as to why it has been allowed to flourish unimpeded for 35 years. Alarm bells have been ringing loud and clear for more than 30 years now about how easy it is for separating parents to subvert the course of justice in a perjury-friendly family court. Today's program again illustrates how easy it is for both fathers and mothers to be separated from their children when a malicious, vindictive ex-partner decides to make use of false sex abuse and domestic violence allegations in order to obtain valuable time to set in motion the insidious parental alienation process, which turns children against their own family. The outpouring of such contrived anger and hate towards an estranged parent or sibling is not the behaviour of an independently thinking child, but rather that of a disempowered child whose captured mind has been highly manipulated by a malicious, self-serving individual or group. These children, by and large, started out with a deep love for both of their parents, yet are forced to hate and turn their back on half of their biological family. We simply cannot continue to sweep this injustice aside, turn a blind eye to their plight, and deny them the dignity, support, and protection they're entitled to by virtue of existing international human rights conventions. The family justice system, when awarding primary custody to only one parent, provides a fertile breeding ground for this situation to flourish. Cut off from rational alternative point of views, these children are programmed to turn against the very people who are able to provide a healthy balance to their life during their formative childhood years, thereby effectively stifling their chances of growing into well-balanced and emotionally stable adults. Up to a quarter of the Western nation's children now are growing up in an environment where hating the other parent is encouraged and rewarded. These vulnerable children know that in order to survive, they have to go along with this doctrine of hate. The psychological effects on the children of forcibly having to exist in the toxic atmosphere of so much hate can be absolutely devastating. It's no accident that so many of our children are acting out in anger at having been abandoned in a hostile environment by a society which forces them to have to deal alone with complex problems they can't possibly comprehend or resolve. Many of these vulnerable, unfortunate children are growing up with perverse views and opinions which are based on a distorted perception of reality forced upon them by a disturbed, dysfunctional adult. The question has to be asked of the supporters of this travesty of justice as to just what part of the words justice and equality they have so much difficulty with. Okay, we'll go to a break and return to speak with Diana. Diane, welcome to Dad's on the Air, and thank you for joining us today to tell us your story.
Thank you for inviting me to tell my story.
Now, you're a mother of three children who has unexpectedly found herself in the same nightmare situation so many separated fathers find themselves in once the other parent decides to use the children to punish them for some perceived wrongdoings. So, Diane, let's start at the point where I guess one or both of you decided that the marriage was no longer something that was able to be salvaged. Can you briefly tell us how all this began for you at that point, for you and your children?
Okay. After a 15-year relationship, in April 2005, I told my husband I was tired of his extremely controlling behaviour and that I no longer loved him or wished to have an intimate relationship with him. I had always hoped that we could have a shared care arrangement with the children. And at the time, the children were 13, 10 and 7. His response was that if I didn't love him, then I had to go. And before I could leave, I had to sign the property over to him, which I did under great duress. And I also believed this would be the only way he would allow me to see the children. I knew his personality, and I knew it was not going to be an easy separation.
But you agreed to share the, to have shared care of the children, is that what you said?
Yes, I mean, I'd always had such a very close relationship with all my three children, was a stay-at-home mum all their lives, and I love my role as a mother, actively involved in their education and PNC member at their local school.
And what was the ages of your children at that time?
The oldest, a daughter, was 13, and then I had a son who was 10, and my youngest, a daughter, was 7. So very difficult developmental stages in regards to, you know, how all this can happen,
Yes. Now, Diane, you mentioned that you you left the marital home. In hindsight, do you think this was a wise move?
Well, in my in our relationship, there was, it wasn't as though I had a choice, and all I can say is you have to believe me there. My husband's from the Middle East, the family home was the family home, and if I didn't love him, then I had to go, and that's all there was to it. Wasn't much negotiating, actually.
Now, I understand you just mentioned you signed all your common property over to your ex.
I signed over the house, and he had every single thing in it. I did that to try and relieve, you know, as I said, I knew it wasn't going to be an easy separation. I was ultimately destroying his dream. So it wasn't going to be easy. I was well aware that it wasn't going to be easy, and I was of the belief that if he had the property and all those material things, then, you know, he wouldn't get nasty with the children. And that was my absolute belief.
In hindsight, do you think that was a good move?
Oh, no. Not at all. Not at all. The situation is that it's how a lot of women find themselves in the situation at the moment, because of men are not getting the idea to stay. Somebody has to leave. I left. It's not easy.
But at that time you weren't aware, you hadn't been involved with any legal representation or anything?
No, I had. Look, I had no idea, you know. I mean, I was in a 15-year relationship, very close, my life with my children, and I didn't know really very much about family law or the whole what you do after you separate sort of thing, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And
yes.
I had hoped that we would be able to work that out. I realised I was working with a very difficult person. I knew that was going to be difficult, but, you know, I hoped so. And that was one of the reasons why I signed the house over, you know what I mean? So
yes, you
got that out of the way.
Like most of us, you're not aware in the early stages what you should be doing and shouldn't be doing, and can get caught out like that, can't you?
No, and you don't realise. I mean, you really don't. I think you're trying to keep it... I think you try to keep it and work it out between yourselves, and if anything I know about family law, you know, I've heard that don't go there, whatever, you know what I mean? Because
yes.
Then you have someone else deciding, you know, decisions about your children.
Sure, sure.
You know, so you do want to avoid it. So the simplest and the best solution is that the parents can work it out, and unfortunately the emotions get involved, and then when it turns all nasty and horrid.
So well, of course, one of the worst outcomes is when the children are turned against one or other of their parents. When did you become aware that your ex was attempting to turn your children against you?
Well, my situation was sort of a bit of a difficult one. Although I'd signed the house over to my husband in July, I stayed in the family home until September because, well, the particular area where I live, it's very difficult to find accommodation. So I stayed in the family home, but I was, from then on, forbidden to go upstairs and was downstairs. It was a very, very, very difficult time, which I don't really want to elaborate on now. It's a very emotional and difficult time for all involved.
Were the children being turned against you then? Did you notice any signs of that?
Yes, they were, because whilst I was living in the house, my husband, once the house was signed over, he essentially gave my daughter... I mean, I'd be in the house, but I would have to ask my daughter for permission to touch things or do things. So, she took over my position right from the start. Before I'd left, I mean, I was there still doing, you know, getting the children's lunches, getting, you know, doing all those things that I'd always done, but under very, very difficult situation because, you know.
Well, can you give us some more examples of the of some of the tactics and methods that your ex has used to turn your children against you? I guess there's lots of subtle things that happen that you
In my situation, they weren't subtle. They weren't subtle. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, very loud and clear messages that I was no longer a part of the family,
mm-hmm.
And that as soon as I found my accommodation, I would be gone from their lives. But in having said that,
mm-hmm.
also, I mean, he doesn't like to see the children upset or, you know, distressed, you know, like terribly much. So it was sort of. It was just a very, very difficult period, and there was many, many, many examples of, you know, terrible, just degrading my position in the family in front of the children, you know, mm-hmm. from, you know, you can't sit on that chair, move over there. If you want a cup of tea, you've asked your daughter, you don't touch anything in the house, you are a guest, and you behave yourself. I mean, it was really, really very, very difficult and stressful.
Demeaning,
yes. Stressful. I did whatever, essentially, as I said, when I was in court, if you had told me to stand on my head and sing diddly, I would have. I did whatever it took to keep him as calm as possible under the situation.
And what was the eventual outcome then? Because
well, then I finally found some accommodation in the September. I left with nothing other than my clothing. I wasn't allowed to take anything from the home. And I couldn't leave my children. I mean, I'd had a house to move into. And essentially he had also told the children that Mum would still be coming and, you know, having some meals with us or, you know, cleaning your bedrooms. There was little things that he sort of said that I would still be coming there for. I mean, essentially because I was living there. And I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, how do you really prepare your children that the person that's been, you know, one of their major roles in their life is, you know, is no longer going to be a part of it? I mean, I couldn't leave my children. I had the house. And so essentially what I was doing was going there after school. Of course, I would ring. It was arranged with him. He was always very difficult, but I knew if I didn't ring him, it would upset him. But essentially, it sort of went like, okay, when the kids come home from school, I'll be there. And I would leave after they'd had their meals, bathed, and they were in bed, because the routine was that I did those things and then read a story and they went off to sleep. And I just, for me, if I'd read, put him into bed and read a story and they went to sleep, then I could go. Then I could go. He used to want me to stay and talk with him. I had nothing to talk to him about. I thought his behaviour to me and the treatment of me, well, his actions spoke much louder than words. So I didn't want to talk with him, and I went, and I'd say, I'll be back to do the same tomorrow. But, of course, the rules changed every time I come, and sometimes I didn't stay and do as I planned because it caused so much trauma to the children. He might, you know, get me to do humiliating things, which, as I said, a lot of the time I did them. Sometimes I just thought it best that I leave for the children and myself, yeah. And because he was so, so hysterical. I mean, he was very, very, very angry, to say the least.
Yes, yes.
And then eventually they ended up, I mean, and he was also, I'd moved out, and he did allow me to take my youngest, but as he saw fit, now when he decided, he would not allow me to take the older two children and insisted that they were in their home where they belonged, and when they felt like going to my house or visiting me, they would.
So
I was taking the youngest daughter initially, and as I was saying, so this went on for about 3 weeks. It was a very difficult period for all involved, and then one evening I had arranged to pick up my daughter, and you know, it was a difficult time. Ended up, you know, being an argument, and I was physically thrown from the family's home and told to get up for my safety, and if I dared come back onto the property, he would, now because the property actually belonged to him, he would have me done for trespassing. I never went back there again. I knew who I was dealing with. I grabbed my daughter at the time, and we went home, and that's when I went to Women's Services, and I was strongly advised to him, you know, that I wouldn't be able to work this out with this person, and that I desperately needed some legal advice. And if I didn't do it as soon as practically possible, I would be seen as a a mother who's actually abandoned her children, which I couldn't believe that
I guess
be the case, but essentially that's exactly what happens.
Yes, yeah. I guess that's the same, applies to the same as men. If they leave, that they can be seen to be, often the parent left with the children actually puts that in the children's heads that the other parents abandoned them.
That's right. And I mean, one of the parents is gone, you know, so the children's left with a, you know, with that parent, and
they're in total control, aren't they?
Right.
From that point onwards,
you know, and they've seen the power wielded, and as it was pointed out in court, my children had lived this their entire life with the father that, with total control in the house. So, you know, they knew who was boss. Yeah, as they say, they know which side the bread's buttered on. You know,
exactly.
Say, yeah.
We're speaking with Australian mother of three, Diana. We'll be back after the break.
Our children are stolen, my stealth and deceit, by brainwashing parents who charm, lie and cheat. They're soon taught to hate a parent they once loved. Our poor little children, enough is enough. Caught in a trap, they must learn to survive, so they join with their parent who hates, cheats and lies. After a while, they both act the same, the brainwashing parent and a child without shame. A child is not born with hate in their heart, it's taught in a household where parents live apart. The parents they live with use fear and control to brainwash their children, since the court gave them this role.
Our children are stolen by stealth and deceit, by brainwashing parents who charm, lie and cheat. They're soon taught to hate a parent they once loved. Our poor little children, enough is enough. The child does not know when deception occurs. They're too young to recognize denigration and slurs. To hate the other parent is rewarded with praise. They're not free to think as they're locked in a cage. Surely it's abuse when this behavior persists. Their childhood destroyed by these parental terrorists. Dysfunctional thoughts can make them angry or depressed. Inflicted by these parents who are sick and obsessed. Our children are stolen by stealth and deceit, by brainwashing parents who charm, lie and cheat. They're soon taught to hate a parent they once loved. Our poor little children, enough is enough. One day the child will seek out the past. Faced with the truth, it will leave them aghast. They will discover how lies changed their life, how helpless they were, and how lucky to survive. To all who take part or do nothing to prevent this abuse of our children who continue to lament the loss of a parent when they are growing up. You will stand condemned as weak and corrupt. Our children are stolen by stealth and deceit, by brainwashing parents who charm, lie and cheat. They're soon taught to hate a parent they once loved. Our poor little children, enough is enough. We're back with Dads on the Air.
We're back with our special guest this week, Diana. So, Diana, at that point, I guess you started to get become aware of the legal aspects of your case. And so, which one of you instigated court proceedings?
Well, I did initially. I engaged a lawyer. Last time I went out to the property was sometime in October. Women's Services got lots of advice. Engaged a lawyer early December, which is everybody's going into Christmas mode. It's not, you know, a fun time to be engaging a lawyer. And then sort of got my story, you know, to him. He just said, well, that's just not on. We have, you know, rules in this country, and sort of told me my rights, insisted strongly that I contest the property, the order. I said it would only cause me so much grief that it's just not worth it. He told me again my rights and strongly suggested I do that. So I had time to think about that, and then in the January, 31st of January 2006, papers were served on my partner, and you know the court process. Begun.
Commenced, yeah. Now, in that process, your ex was able to successfully take out an AVO out against you. Can you tell us how he was able to do this?
Well, I'll just like to pull back there a little, because essentially, so I instigated matters of the courts, and then there was an interim court orders made in February. That the youngest child have contact with me, and the oldest two children, because they were sort of so resistant, they just sort of was ordered on a Sunday, each Sunday from 9 to 5 was ordered. That was an interim order because of the resistance.
Okay.
And then the father responds back to that order, wanting that order dismissed.
He wanted you to have no contact with the kids.
We went into court. Actually, we went into court over 8 times through the course of 2006. So he went into court having that application dismissed. He wanted the two older children to have contact with me as they agreed. And he actually did agree to the youngest child having the three-day, four-day, you know, week-about sort of arrangement with the youngest child, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's what was in place. So that continued on until April, but that was fraught with lots of dramas at pick-up, at, you know, my children would refuse to speak to me, or if they did, they'd come to the car and, you know, threaten things like, if you don't sign custody over our dad, you won't see us until we're 18, or I won't come and have my birthday with you.
Blackmail.
Many of those things, which I would say things like, if your father wants to tell me something, then he can get out of the car and tell me himself. It's not, you know, things like that. One of the best things I did after going to the family... the Women's Services was get a very good book on divorce, and I really stuck to their guidelines, and that was first, you know, not bagging or saying bad things about the other parent, and letting the children know at all times that any decisions that were being made were now in the hands of lawyers and judges, and
yes.
That, you know, I wasn't about to do deals with children. I understood
yes.
that they had... I mean, I knew that the father was... what the father was up to. I knew his personality. I've lived with him for 15 years and seen him ostracise many, many people throughout our relationship. Anybody that didn't agree was ostracised, was simply cut. You know, that was it.
Yes.
You're either with me or you're not.
Yes.
So just in regards to the AVO, because, yes, the AVO does come in, but there was that sort of... There was interim orders.
Yes.
It didn't work. And also it didn't work, and it would have been infuriating... my husband, because, you know, my daughter would arrive, you know, when I'd get her, and, you know, there'd be all sorts of things like, you know, if I didn't have to come to your place, I could have went here. You know, there was always, it was really always quite difficult when I first picked her up. And then she'd usually go quiet, and it usually wasn't until the last day she had with me that she'd often open up and might say a few things.
Yes.
But she was definitely going being put under a lot of pressure because she was the only one that was actually wanting to have contact, you know what I mean? She was seven, you know, it was very difficult for her.
And when you first pick them up, they're often programmed to be very antagonistic towards
her. Oh, she'd be angry the minute she'd get in the car and, you know, it's not fair, Dad, and you know, the brothers and sisters are going such and such place, and I have to go to your stupid place, and I'd get a barrage. But I mean, I'd just sit and listen to it, you know, drive with her, and as I said, by the time we'd get home, and I'd have the cats and, you know, the things that she loved there, and she'd settle into it, and usually, as I said, be quiet, and then, you know, sort of speak maybe a little bit more openly on the third day, and then she'd be back to Dad. So, you know, and I can't even imagine what the barrage she would entail when she got home. And it was because it wasn't only the father that was trying to...
The siblings as well.
Her. It was the siblings, actually, that were then giving her the really hard time because she was the only one that wasn't, you know, on their side.
Yes.
It was a very difficult position for her, you know. She's a courageous girl, that's all I can say.
So you were developing a relationship with your youngest daughter, and was that the cause for your ex to take out an AVO?
Then what happened, just essentially out of the blue, although the last time I had my daughter, it was quite interesting, in hindsight, it's a wonderful thing, but she actually did give me a little note, and it was all stapled within a handmade envelope, and it was all stapled up with, you know, 20 staplers all around. It was all very, very secretive, and when I opened it, it didn't really make much sense to me, because it was a thank you letter for being my mum. That's essentially what the letter was. It was a thank you letter for being my mum. Keep warm and smile, and I thank you so much for being my mum. And it didn't really make much sense to me at the time. But so I probably got that letter, you know, on a Tuesday or Wednesday. But then I realised when I got a call through from my lawyer, and he said that a notice of child abuse had been filed. Father files notice of child abuse. And so when my lawyer told me this, I mean, I laughed. Like what? Like, you could be joking.
Was this sexual abuse he was accused?
It was sexual, and that's what he said, unfortunately, it's sexual abuse. Which, again, just...
That's pretty difficult for a male to accuse the female ex-partner of sexual abuse. How can you give us an idea of how he went about this?
Well, essentially, I believe he went to several lawyers, and he would have been told, like I was told, the new amended laws, 2006, 50-50 shared parenting, pretty much down the line with poverty settlements. You know, it's meant to be.
Yes.
You know, that's what we're led to believe.
Yes, yes.
He didn't like hearing that, and that's what I'm saying. When people don't like to do 50-50 or fair, or in fact, just don't want to do such a thing, well, and as he would have been told, unless there's allegations of physical or sexual abuse, then you'll have to share the arrangement, care, you know, and the property assets with your wife. So that's what he would have been told, and so then he'd by this time borrowed a significant sum of money and had a fistful of money and engaged himself a very expensive legal firm. And this legal firm is based in Brisbane, and they are known for their aggressive style. And essentially, it just became a nightmare. We were just barraged with stuff. I was represented by legal aid, and I'm not... to get on here and badmouth lawyers and what have you. I mean, they have a job to do, but my case was dealt with very, very, very badly as a consequence of being a legal aid case, and I was up against my husband, who spent $72,000. He had, you know, a fistful of money. As my lawyer said, he's spending money like water. We were just bombarded with, you know, there was a notice filed of abuse.
What are you able to, or did you want to describe what sort of abuse was actually alleged?
It, uh, it was alleged that I had sexually abused both of the two children that were resisting having contact with me, the son and the daughter, at this stage.
And what type of sexual abuse are you able? Do you want to mention it?
It was quite. I mean, I don't know how explicit you want me to be, but
because it's so difficult.
Digital penetration in my daughter's vagina.
So this is what a man, an ex-husband, is accusing you of doing that.
Yes.
Without any evidence.
Without any evidence, she had to go and tell her story to, try and convince people of her story to quite a few places. Because, of course, the juvenile investigation squad was...
Comes into
first
that,
of all, doctors involved.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they're notified. I believe that's where the abuse notification come from. It comes mm-hmm. from docs. Come from docs, and then as a consequence, then my daughter was interviewed by by JURT, which is, I believe, an acronym for junior investigation, squad dealing with sexual assault. She was interviewed with them. At first it was very difficult because my daughter was so hysterical. That was the thing. My daughter was so hysterical and so emotional and crying, and I mean, she was recommended, to mental health. I mean, she was in a terrible state.
And she was
This is a difficult thing. So they sort of at first thought, well, if a mother has done this to her, then of course this is why she's behaving like this. But the truth of the matter, and they weren't aware of this at the time, was that she was fabricating sexual assault. Which, for my daughter, all her life, she had been protected as a mother and a father. We had protected our children from, wherever we possibly could. So for her to have to turn around and allege that her mother, that we had, as I said, we had until this, a wonderful relationship.
How old was she at that time?
Horrendous. She'd turned 13. She'd turned 13 in the January.
And she had to go up and fabricate these stories. So.
But then the situation was that they didn't actually believe her. They believed she was delivering scripted lines.
Mm-hmm.
And actually what probably alerted to them to the most was the father's behaviour, because he was adamant. He wanted me locked up. He wanted me gone. He was, insisting that I was a pedophile and I should be in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And when the police and the docs, the lady that was with her from docs, sort of told my ex-husband that they wouldn't be pressing any charges, I mean, he even, and it's actually in the judgment, went to the extreme of saying, I'll take my daughter back to the child psychologist and he'll tell her exactly what to say and then you'll believe her. I mean, it was really, he was hell-bent, and he was getting, and he actually, in the records, he put his hand over the policewoman's mouth and all sorts of things because he wasn't being believed. And he wanted to be believed. He wanted my daughter to be believed. And he was, saying things like, she wants justice, and she wants justice, and all that sort of stuff. So
actually, what was the...
And I have all those files here because I ended up getting all of them off my lawyer,
And so what was the response of the judiciary in the end? Because these turned out to be false allegations. What was their reactions then?
Absolutely. Well, they did. There wasn't any consequences. If I want consequences to come from making false allegations, I've got to take it out of family court and into the civil court.
Did they make any comments from the bench?
Only to say, other than he was a despicable, any parent they found getting a child, coercing a child into making false allegations, they would find them a despicable parent. That was it.
But no.
No, we could go off on a tangent now, but apparently then. That becomes a civil matter, false allegations.
So you have to take it to civil court?
Apparently so, yes. I'm not going to get... I mean, I believe in the 2006 amended family law amendments, they've made a little clause in there saying that because they are aware that parents do fabricate things. They definitely are aware of that.
It runs rife in the family court, doesn't it?
That's right. So they are aware of it. So they've actually implemented, or whatever the terminology is, consequences for parents making false allegations. But I don't know what the consequence is. I haven't got anywhere. And that was another thing that was so upsetting when I finally got my final judgment, because everybody would say, wait until you get the final judgment and then we'll be able to do something for you. Even the police said, you know, if it comes back that this was done on malicious grounds, then you make it a civil matter. Well, it come back stating very clearly in the judgment that it was done for malicious purposes at every single turn and with no regards to the children's best interest whatsoever.
But he was able to get away with doing it.
So essentially he was able to get away with it. And I would not have believed that this would be possible other than I've lived it. And all I can say is I have a huge empathy for men, because I'd hate to be a man in my situation. I had police speak to me. I had a policewoman speak to me so rudely that I had to turn, because we were in a court situation, and she told me to get over here. And I actually turned around because I didn't know who she was talking to. And I said to her, I had actually some support from the women's services, and I said to her, please don't speak to me like that, I've done nothing wrong. And she just says, not what your 13-year-old daughter's alleging. And I just said, well, I don't have time to fill you in all the details at the moment, but believe me, she's been put up to this by her father. But I was treated terribly. And when you think about it, they don't like men that abuse children. They hate women that do, you know what I mean?
Right.
There's that double whammy. Because even the lady of the women's service that were there with me couldn't believe how terrible the policewoman was to me.
That's interesting, isn't
but
it?
But I stood my, I didn't deserve to be spoken to that. I was only being accused. These were allegations. This was a family law matter that, was being dealt with very badly.
We're speaking with our special guest, Diana. We'll be back after the break.
Causes devastation through manipulation and intimidation. It's practiced by a parent through indoctrination. The children do not know it as they're kept in isolation. One parent disappears by elimination through misinformation. Lots of fabrication. Little brains are wired by constant stimulation against the other parent with great determination. Parental alienation, it causes devastation through manipulation and intimidation. Practiced by a parent through indoctrination. The children do not know it as they're kept in isolation. No more expectation of parents' visitation. Nothing is now positive, only denigration. All attempted contact create a complication. Memories are erased with determined application. Parental alienation, it causes devastation through manipulation and intimidation. It's practiced by a parent through indoctrination. The children do not know it as they're kept in isolation. Children, despite our protestation, the court will not act to help our situation. Dare to speak out, you invite recrimination, which destroys your reputation by nasty imputation. Parental alienation, it causes devastation abuse, a cruel abomination. The courts must stand up to save their reputation, eliminate this practice of parental alienation. This practice by a parent, true indoctrination. The children do not know it as they're kept in isolation. Parental alienation, it causes devastation through manipulation and intimidation. This practice by a parent, true indoctrination. The children do not know what is in. We're back with Dads on the Air.
We're back with our special guest this week, Diana. At a later point, he took an AVO out. When that didn't work, I suppose he took an AVO out.
Oh, no, well, the 13th of April 2006, father filed a notice of child abuse. And then on the 19th of April, just to add the icing to the cake, he was able to walk into a police station, into a local police station. He made ridiculous allegations that I abused him and my children daily, and that he would no longer wanted to be abused, and that the children were afraid to go to school because I also went there and verbally abused them, and they were terrified to go to school. So he got an AVO that the minute they finished writing it, it was his ticket to keep me away from my children, and it was 100 metres from wherever my children may be in the world.
Now, can you tell our listeners some of the absurd and bizarre repercussions of this AVO, like the police taking out a measuring tape?
I'd just like to explain also with the AVO. So he took that AVO on the 19th of April. It didn't get to court until the 10th of May. So mm-hmm. I got to court a month later.
Right.
I turned up. It was adjourned. Again, it was put over for hearing on the 14th of June. I turned up, it was adjourned. It was again put to hearing at the 23rd of August. So look how much time he's won now. These are just allegations. I haven't been any trial, anything. It's only he's gone into a police station and said, I've done this. So we find, actually it was the 23rd of August. I was actually staying at the time in a safe house, and I looked in my diary and thought, oh no, I'm meant to be an hour and 10-15 minute drive away. I rang my lawyer and just said, oh, for goodness sakes, I'm meant to be having my AVO heard. And he just said, don't worry, if you don't turn up, they'll adjourn it. Don't worry about it. Ring the courts after 12 to find out what happened. I did that. And they'd heard it. And so he got a beautiful 2-year AVO. Mm. And it was seen because I didn't turn up on this occasion that, obviously it must be true.
Yes. So what were the bizarre... As I said earlier, there was some absurd and bizarre repercussions
It happened in probably about a couple of months after he got the AVO, mm-hmm. as I said before, I was very, very involved in my children's education, school life. And at this stage, I hadn't seen my children for quite some months now, and I needed to see their faces. So I sat across the road from the school. There's a little bit of a park, and there was mm-hmm. a bench. And I went there probably about 8 o'clock in the morning, and I had a newspaper, and I sat there. And all I wanted to do was see my children as they got off the bus, see their faces. The headmaster come over. He knew me very well from the school. He come over to see if I was okay, and I assured him that I was just sitting at the table. Even if I wanted to move, I would be unable to. I was sitting there for the purpose just to grab a glimpse of my children's face before I forgot what they looked like. That's how I mean, I was very upset. I mean, very upset, but in no, you know, to do nothing other than sit and, you know, to look. That's all
yes.
I wanted to do. And then, as I said to the headmaster, I wouldn't do anything, you know, silly or approach them in any way. Or, I mean, they knew my very, very difficult situation. And as I assured him, I wasn't going to make matters worse for myself. I just literally was... Anyway, so he was fine with all that.
They would have had a copy of the AVO, I guess.
Yes. Of course, as soon as he got that, he was taking
meters.
It wherever. You know, he took that to everywhere because that was his proof that I was definitely a violent and abusive
yes,
woman.
Yes.
So that was a wonderful little document for him.
Mm,
So, and then the police, the school could not, and then, I mean, I finished my chat with the headmaster. He, he was very, very good and you know, was sure that I wasn't going to do anything, and he left me. Also, the lady from the office come over. I'd known her for many years as well,
mm-hmm.
and she sort of had a few comforting words. I assured her that I wasn't going to do anything, and I'd be going as soon as I'd seen them.
And then the police turned up.
Anyway, so as a consequence of that, probably, you know, this was early in the morning, probably about 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock that morning, they were all shocked when the police turned up to say that there'd been a breach of an order. And... they got their measuring tapes out and they actually measured from, you know, the school to the park if I'd actually breached an order. They were filled in a little bit by the school of what was, you know, going on. They didn't have
any idea. And the police got their measuring tape out.
They actually got their measuring tape out.
Unbelievable.
All was question. You know, there was questioning happening all over the place. You know, this person, you know, the headmaster was questioned, the office ladies were questioned, because they had both, I mean, they had witnessed me there. They knew exactly what had happened. So they were, you know, it was good that they'd come over and spoke to me. They knew my state of mind, all of that. So they were able to pass all that on to the police and assure the police that I had never in any way, as I'd said to the police, a simple phone call to the school would have let you know that I have never, ever gone to the school and abused my children in any way, shape or form. A simple phone call. Anyway, so they come out. And another time they were called because I was seen hugging my daughter. And that was actually when I first got the AVO on. I just remember that was the first time he rang the police about me breaking the AVO, but they didn't come out that time. But he went into the school and he was very angry with the school because the situation was I was there in my small little... I live in a very small community. I was there... one afternoon, I think, after school, and my daughter, I might have been getting milk at the local, checking my mail, I don't know, very quickly. I didn't expect to see her, but she happened to be out at the gate, and she called out to me. She called out Mummy, you
and
know,
this is
like
your,
I was across
your,
the crossing.
This is your youngest daughter?
My youngest
and
daughter.
Who was old? How
and
old?
And I had the AV, sorry?
How old was she then?
She was eight. So
mm.
I, you know, as I said, it was an accidental thing I'd mm. gone, but she was, wasn't, she was in at where she was, and she shouldn't have been, but that's just what I call one of those chance meetings.
Yes.
Because I'd sort of gone a little bit earlier to avoid seeing them at the school time, you know what I mean? Because I realised it would only upset them as much as it upset me,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
And she called out to you.
Anyway, so I was, as I said, I believe I was checking my mail, and on my way back to the car, and I hear Mummy, you know, Mummy. And I see my daughter, and she's with a couple of other little friends, and she's waving out to me. And I stood the other side of the crossing, and I went, oh, no, if you go over there, you know, you risk, you know, you'll be in trouble because you'll break your order. And then, what can you do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I run across, and I gave her a hug, and I told her, you know, that I loved her, and I had to hug her quickly, and I had to go, because, in fact, I would be in trouble, you know, because I was, in fact, breaking my AVO. That was reported. So I don't know who witnessed that, but somebody reported that to the school that my ex was up there saying that I had broken my AVO, and the school just said, look, apparently all she did was hug her daughter. And then he told the school it wasn't for them to decide if it was inappropriate or appropriate, that there was an AVO and they had to adhere to it. You know, he was threatening to take my children from the school and all sorts of stuff if they didn't, you know, obey by the thing, by the AVO. Then they realised, and that's why when they saw me, you know, a month or two later or three mm-hmm. months later, whatever it was, when I was sitting there just at the bench, you know.
It's a terrible situation.
Yes, but nothing happened for that hug, but they did come out. And he got them out on that occasion because not my youngest daughter, but my oldest daughter had seen me on the school bus sitting on the bench, and she rang her father, who then turned it into, you know, calling the police and
they have to respond.
Yes.
Yeah.
And as they say, we have to respond. There's been a complaint.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And I know they're just doing their job as well.
That's right. You can't actually blame them. They're caught in the middle as well.
No.
So, Diane, do you blame your ex or the system that allows him to behave in this manner with impunity, basically?
I blame the system.
Yes.
The system, if you want to alienate your children, you know, it can absolutely work for you. If you choose to go down that line.
And it happens to so many, unfortunately. Hundreds of thousands of kids are...
And they think with these new amended laws, 50-50 shared parenting is going to, you know, stop this sort of things happening in the court. But I would have to argue that it's only going to escalate and have more cases, because you're dealing with emotions. People get angry. They get vindictive. They're unable to control their emotions. But
if people know from the word go, once you separate, that you, both parents are going to have a continue a relationship with their children, then there's no point in trying to separate the other parent, because they're not going to have that outcome. Under the current system, they're able to do this, like you say, with false allegations, with an AVO.
And unless there's a good reason why their parents should not be in their lives, and a reason being if there's a history of physical or sexual abuse, then no, they should not play a part in their lives. Mm. I mean...
But that's why they use this.
That is exactly why.
It's the number one weapon.
Allegations are used.
Yeah.
Because, as I said, you know, I know from my experience that my ex went to 3 or 4 lawyers, because I was... The thing is, we've got to get a lawyer, and then you can't have... You know, he'd gone many places, and I'd go there, and they'd say to me, I'm sorry, we can't deal with you because your partner's already been here. So I knew he was sort of trying out all the lawyers around town, and he would have been getting... the same advice that I was getting, that it will be 50-50, everything's 50-50, unless there's, you know, serious allegations of physical or sexual abuse. So, I mean, that's how it is, simplistically.
Yes.
So, okay, and so parents that don't want to deal with a fair system, then they can very, very easily, as I say, play the game, you know.
Yes.
Take this course, you know, this stratagem.
And they certainly get advised that by
I
lawyers.
I also think you need to have some money and a bit of a law firm that doesn't mind, you know, taking your money. I mean, I'm going to say it. I think it is and should be absolutely against humanity that, you know, he spent $72,000 borrowed dollars to play this game.
Which will come out of your children's inheritance in the end.
Which ultimately comes out of, the children's, you know, family, you know, inheritance or whatever you want to call it. That's right. I mean, the lawyers got more than I did.
I've often said it, the law profession is plundering the family wealth, you know, from separated parents.
Why should anybody have to pay that sort of money to go through this process to get contact or
with
get
your own children.
Sorted out with your family situation. It's just
ridiculous.
I wouldn't have believed it if I didn't actually have a copy of how much he spent with his lawyer. But you know what? The craziest thing about that, having said that, after spending $72,000 with his legal firm, we had a 5-day trial to go into. They signed him off. He then had to go and find himself a lawyer. He applied for and was granted legal aid after spending $72,000.
So let's move forward a little bit. Now, you've ended up with, after drawn-out court proceedings, what's been the eventual outcome? Do you have any contact with the children at all? And you have one living with you, is that right? What's the outcome?
It's been a bit of a drawn-out process, and we're actually in our fourth year, but I will no longer go any further in the courts.
Do you have any contact orders? Or?
I have, as a consequence, like the final hearing, the final judgment was that my youngest daughter was removed from her father, removed from her father's care, placed into my sole care. The mother had sole parental responsibility for the day-to-day and long-term care, welfare and development of the child, of the youngest child, and she has to have no contact with her father or siblings, unless, and this is the whole irony of it, we can mutually agree to some contact. So after going through, you know, 3 years of a nightmare through the family law process, the judgment in relation, so that's the judgment for my youngest daughter, mm-hmm. and then there's been no orders made for my oldest daughter because they've considered her age. She's mm-hmm. now, you know, at the time when the judgment came down, she was 16 and a half. She's now 17. So the judge made no orders there. And for my son, who's now 13, the only orders are that we can agree to something. We have to mutually agree to some contact.
So
I have parent. I still have parental responsibility, and my ex is meant to ring me about his education.
But they don't.
All those things. That's all, you know, been written in there in the orders. But
pie in the sky
does not happen at all.
Do your children have any contact with one another at all?
No. No. Unless they accidentally bump. We live in the same town. We have a little laugh amongst my daughter and I. You know, we often meet them, or my son in particular, at Coles.
Mm-hmm.
On a little shopping so they do little catch-ups there, and I've just got the internet on at home, so my daughter has, with my blessings, started SMS, whatever it's called, you know, when they chat on the line to each other.
Yeah.
And she's sort of tracked down her brother's site and...
So there's a little bit of contact there.
No response. And any phone calls, the minutes my voice is heard, the phone's put down. Very, very difficult.
Yeah, that's typical. Do the children living with your ex have any contact with the maternal side of their family, like your...
None whatsoever. They were cut off a long time ago as well. My oldest daughter actually told my... auntie, a very, very close auntie of mine, who's always acted as like a grandparent, really, to my children. When we separated, my daughter rung her to say that she no longer wished her to send any presents or wished to speak to her.
Mm. Now, there was a recent case that you mentioned to me off air that your daughter living with you recently wanted... to meet with her siblings who are living with your ex,
mm-hmm.
To give them some presents. Can you tell me that what happened then in the park?
Yes, that was actually last year.
Okay.
It was actually my ex partner's is of the Jewish faith, so it was it was Hanukkah. It was a holiday sort of close to Christmas. So it was last year. It was actually early December, and. You know, I wanted my daughter to... Well, I gave my blessings. There was talk with the ICL about arranging some sort of meeting. You know, there'd been X amount of months since the judgment was handed down. You know, these children hadn't had contact with each other for it was going on like 12, 13, 14 months now. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's a long time.
Sure.
It was just ridiculous. And because the order was, as we mutually agreed... Then I actually rang, my ex-partner has businesses in town, I rang and actually got my oldest daughter on the phone. She's very involved in the restaurant. She answered the phone. Normally when she'd hear my voice, she would hang up, but I sort of pleaded with her just to hear me out. And would she like to meet with her sister to exchange some Hanukkah gifts, because we give gifts, presents. She agreed to that, which shocked me. So we agreed to meet in the local park, and I just thought, oh, my goodness, there's finally this little... with this glimmer of hope, you know? Like, oh, my goodness, you know what I mean? Like, wow, she's actually agreed to meeting. So I got off the phone and my youngest daughter was very, very surprised, and I said, well, she's agreed to meet. You know, they're going to meet you. And so it was all very exciting, and so we went the next day and bought the gifts, and she excitedly picked all those things out, and lovingly and excitedly picked those things out. And it was during the school holidays, so we met with them the next day around 11 o'clock.
And your son was there as well?
My son was coming as well. So we sort of, we were waiting for them, and we were sitting on a bench in the park, and she was sort of getting very anxious. It was about 11:05, and I assured her they would be there, so just calm down and all would be well. And then we saw them coming, and I was so excited. I mean, I can't begin to tell you how much... Well, it was, to me, like such a breakthrough moment, you know?
Yes, yes.
And anyway, so we saw them coming, and the minute they crossed the road and got up onto the footpath, my son just, I was shocked to say the least. He ordered me to stay where I was. I mean, he was quite... hysterical, you know, he was very agitated. He told me to, pointing at me to stay where I was. I assured him that I wasn't going to go anywhere.
And he was only 12 at the time?
He was 12. I was even quite surprised because we were in a public situation. I didn't think he'd quite act like this, but obviously, you know...
The power of brain...
I'm a trigger. He sees me and he goes into this full-on...
The power of brainwashing.
Brainwashing, and... So he insisted that I assured him that I wasn't going to approach them in any way, but I would like to say hello, you know, hello sort of thing. He was hysterical and just kept shouting. Actually, he was ordering me to go and sit over on another bench to go out. You know, and I assured him that I would do that. I just wanted to say hello. But by this time, my daughter, she had literally... all but dropped to the ground. She doubled over and she begged her brother. She just literally cried and she begged her brother not to do it. And I tried to appeal to him that, look at your sister, you know, we haven't come for this. We've come to exchange gifts. They were chosen with love. This whole meeting was meant to be a sign of love and moving forward. But he wasn't in that mode at all. So I did as he told. If I had been stronger, I possibly should have taken my daughter and stopped the meeting and went as a strong message back to them that we won't be treated like that. But I didn't because I wanted, you know, my daughter had to, you know...
Yes, the presence and wanted
and
to...
And I didn't want it when we got in the car. It was my fault that the meeting didn't take place, you know what I mean? So I chose instead to go and sit over on the bench and to give them their space. So, and I gave them, plenty of space, and I just observed them, and I sat there observing them, just not believing my situation. They, she sat in the middle, and they sort of blocked me out anyway. Anyway, I let that go on for probably about 20 minutes. I had no idea what was being said. I could see my older daughter talking to her a lot. My youngest daughter just sort of sat. She was very, very, she was still, she sobbed. She was, you know, when... You know when you cry really, and she cried so heartily when we first met that she was actually still sobbing, you know what I mean? So I could sort of still see her sobbing from it. And she was just sort of, she was being talked at by my oldest daughter. And then anyway, so I sort of...
She's only 6 or 7 at that time?
No, by this stage, because this is a couple of years on now, so she's actually, you know, 10.
Oh, 10 years on, yeah.
That's right, you know.
And she's sobbing away there, yeah.
Going into the fourth, you know, this was late last year, so, you know, it was 3 years ago. We're into our fourth year this year. So, anyway, so after probably about half an hour, I could see that my son was getting very restless, and I got up slowly to approach him to sort of say that I'd like to wind up now. And the minute he caught me out of the corner of his eye getting up off the bench, he just went into his... He jumped up off the seat and told me to stay where I was. And I said that, that was it now. I was going to take my daughter and we would be leaving. Anyway, so they both got up and my daughter was left on the bench with the gifts still. And I sort of called out, what about the gifts? And my daughter just said, let's just get in the car, don't say anything. And I'm like, but what about the gifts? Why didn't they receive your gifts? Like, I was devastated.
Yes.
And she just said, don't worry about it. Can we just get in the car? Then when we got in the car, I tell you what, she broke down like it was something very, very cruel. And she said she didn't want to see her brother and sister again because she was so, because they had been so mean. Not only to her, to me, it was devastating. It was, it was a terrible, terrible, terrible thing to have gone through and to have witnessed, and especially as a mother knowing what our relationship was. You know, it was, it was heartbreaking. You know, I had to drive off then, but yet we ended up having to pull over. We were both so distressed from it. And she said she didn't want to ever see them again if they were going to continue being mean like that.
The system has a lot to answer for, doesn't it?
So that's the situation. So at this stage, I mean, my daughter was returned to me in September 2007, and so she's been separated from her siblings since that time. And that was the like one arranged meeting, and I mean that also had the blessing of the ICL, the independent children's lawyer. I had rang because they were trying to get some meeting happening anyway, and I sort of took the opportunity, well, it's Hanukkah coming up, what about if I suggest a meeting, you know. So that was all run by the ICL. I now that she actually speaks to me if I ring her up. And she thought that was a good idea, and because it was in the orders that, we mutually agreed to it and he'd agreed to it, so, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So, but that was, and I would not, it was obvious to me. I know, I've seen my son and children in this process in terrible situations and terrible situations of resistance, you know, within the, in the court. In different court, called you in to have reports done and things like that, but I mean, they were so resistant that they've never even viewed me with my children. Because in the process of a report, right, they often like to view both parents with the children, but because my children were so adamantly resisting any contact whatsoever, I didn't get that opportunity. I mean, I had a son threatening to firstly break his thumb if the courts forced him to have contact with me, and then the breaking the thumb wasn't good enough, so then he started threatening suicide. So it was pretty, you know, when you're dealing with threats like that, they have to take those threats very seriously. And
it's terrible, that
absolutely terrible,
that one parent is able to sabotage the family relations with the with the other parent. You know, one parent can do that. The system allows them to do that, and it happens in hundreds of thousands of cases around the country. And
I believe there's plenty of evidence of it.
Reports coming out like that all the time, and the statistics shows there's the 700,000 Australian kids who have little or no meaningful contact with half of their biological families. That's just in Australia alone. We're speaking with Australian mother of three, Diana. We'll be back after the break.
If you are a child in a one-parent home, the thoughts that you think may not be your own. When you're old enough, independent of thought, search for your lost parent, challenge what you were taught. You may have a family who is loving and kind, whose true lies and deception have been wiped from your mind. It's not your fault this injustice occurred, so search for your family and don't be deterred. Kept as a hostage to the truth you were blind, so try and make contact for your own peace of mind. Grandparents and other family have all disappeared. They've all been prevented from becoming indeed. You have the right to discover for yourself that half of your family who was stolen by stealth. One day you may have children of your own. They'll ask about that family, the one you should have known. It's not your fault this injustice occurred. So search for your family and don't be deterred. Kept as a hostage to the truth you were blind. So try and make contact for your own peace of mind.
Speaking with mother of three, Diana. Diana, because your ex has got two children living with him,
and you've got one with you. He doesn't have, the judge didn't give him the satisfaction of saying that he actually has, he sort of made no orders really, so that he sort of didn't have this bit of paper that sort of said, see, the judge said that, you know, I'm the best parent, and so therefore, you know, I've got custody of you children or full responsibility, or whatever the terminology they like to use now. They don't like to use the word custody. It's, you know,
yeah, it's residential, and all they keep changing
care
it.
Or care.
But what happens in the what happens with the child support payments? How do they sort that out then? If there's no orders that way, but the children are living, two of them are living with the father and one with the mother. How does the child support agency evaluate who pays who?
They still evaluate that he pays for his daughter. I'm a student. I'm studying at university, so I'm not working, and so it's been assessed that he pay me an annual sum of money.
He has to pay you.
Yes.
An annual sum of money
for my daughter. Yes, for the care.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, his part of his contribution to the care of my youngest daughter.
Right, right. And he's found ways around that, I guess,
too. Oh, he's found ways around that.
Right,
he's
right.
Refusing to pay that because...
But anyway, we can go on with that a long time, I suppose. We won't go there. Diana, because of your own experiences, it was interesting you became aware that there was a generational component that you had previously not been aware of. Can you briefly tell us about that?
Yes, well, until this sort of, you know, I didn't know anything about parent alienation until I become involved in the court process. But in fact, I realised myself that I was in fact an alienated child myself. My mother parents separated, you know, in the 70s, and my mother was awarded full custody of she had five children at the time. So back then, you know, dad worked automatically, mum got the children, and when she'd come home from court, it was basically that she'd been given the children that your father didn't want us.
He's abandoned you.
Yeah. I remember he did. He didn't love us. I remember it was her words that he didn't want us. He sort of became. I think he did actually come to court, but he didn't want any of us.
Mm. So she had. That's what you were told.
Mm. And but I know for a fact that I was 10 at the time, so I do have my own very good recollection of events. My father did in fact come to visit us on two occasions, and on the third occasion, Mum had already got a man living with her, and when my father tried to push his way past the man to see his five children, a fight broke out, and my dad never didn't return after that incident. I still to this day remember it vividly, because I ran and got under my bed, and because it was a fight, and there was a fire. I remember there was a fire burning, and I thought I thought my dad was going to get cooked in the fire, basically, as a 10-year-old.
Mm.
And then my poor dad.
You were 10 at the time.
I was 10, and so my dad rang me on my 30th birthday.
20 years later, you got a call from your dad.
Mm-hmm. And by this stage, I'd just not given. I was 30, so I'd given birth to my first daughter. And my dad rang me to wish me a happy 30th birthday. And first of all, I was like, who is this?
Mm.
And he said, it's Dad. And I don't know, what do you say to that? I mean, what do you say to, you know, all I could think was, what about the last 20 birthdays?
Yes.
But at this time, as I said,
you
I
were not
did,
aware.
Had a, I did, no.
You're and not then, aware I'm what not, might have happened.
I wasn't aware that, that. Yeah, so essentially,
that your mother actually alienated you from your father. You weren't aware of that.
No.
No.
No, we were told all the time that he didn't love us, and the lovely word she used to use back then was that he was a poofter. And as a 10-year-old, I had no idea what a poofter was.
So you didn't have a positive response to his phone call then, did you?
Well, it was a shock. It was sort of strange. And I had a young baby, and I had my partner, who, when I sort of said it's my father on the phone, I mean, he just thought it was ridiculous. Like, you know, he wasn't supportive of that anyway. He just I ended up hanging up on my dad because of the things that my ex-partner was. He was my partner at the time.
He was very negative about.
Positive. He wasn't supportive. He laughed at it and thought it was funny. Whole family situation in Australia because he's actually from another country. So.
Now I understand you became aware of what may have happened. You actually confronted your mother about why you were alienated from your father, and she had a way of justifying her unwillingness to talk about this, did she not? You confronted her about, you know, what happened, why you didn't see your father for all those years.
They don't want to talk. She didn't want to talk about it.
No, no. She mentioned something about referred to some book or something. Living her life.
Oh, my mother now is very much an Eckhart Tolle fan, and she just referred me. You know, she's in, you know, living for the now sort of thing. And
so she brushed it off.
Yes, which is all very good. I mean, I'm all for that sort of thinking too, in the past and move on and what have you. But
it's a good cop out, isn't it?
You never can forget, and you never, you know, from 10, I remember wherever I went and I saw families, and I'd see the dad, and I always wanted one of those. Always, all my life, I wanted a dad, and that is why I believe I stayed in my relationship with my partner, even though it was a very controlling relationship, was because I wanted my children to have a father. And even when it comes to the end and we separated, I wanted him still to be very much in their lives. You know, I mean, we were separating, not our children. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
You know, and that's why, I mean, I did a lot of the things that I did up front to, you know, to keep him not getting too crazy about the whole thing. But it's all, none of it's worked. It's just
so
a nightmare.
So there is an intergenerational component to a lot of these cases,
isn't
there?
On his side of the family, his mother his mother did the same thing. His mother alienated him from his family.
As well?
Yes.
So both of you were alienated from
I learned that it wasn't the right thing to do, and he's obviously gone on to, that's the way he deals with things, that, you know, that if you're not with me, then you're against me, you're cut, and that's the way he deals with things. Absolutely a learned thing on his behalf when I know his family situation and I know his mother.
So he was alienated from his father too?
No, it wasn't really, it wasn't so much his father, but it was, his father was ill, so he was sort of taken out of my husband's life at a very young age, when he was three or something. So not there, but with, she's had falling out with family members over money, so then she took her two sons, she only had two sons, from the family. She cut them from the family. So they were cut from, you know, all their, you know, aunts, uncles, cousins, because it was a family sort of thing. So that's how she dealt with it. She just cut them and they had no contact with them. And, you know, this lady's in her 70s now. I think she's just sort of contacted one of her sisters, you know, you know, 40 years has gone past or something.
Yes.
So definitely a generational thing there. My mother also was an alienator, but I don't, but, you know, it wasn't, what she did was not right. But there's consequences.
I mean, absolutely.
Because she has five children and, you know, not really any of us have a relationship with her. I mean, my father's since passed on and I love him, and when I'm in my darkest moments, I actually speak to my dad, so you know what I mean?
Yes.
So even though he was cut from my life when I was 10, I don't know, there's that, still that dream. I don't know, there's still that something, but, you know.
Yes. Diana, we're going to have to wind it up. Finally, what advice do you give to separated parents in order that they may be able to avoid the sort of nightmare you and so many others find themselves in?
Get a grip of their emotions. That's probably the biggest thing. I know that's hard to say, and I know we get angry, and that, you know, as my ex said, I destroyed his dream. Well, my dream was destroyed as well. It wasn't what I had planned for my life. But no matter what, as when you were together, you assured your children that you loved them, and all your actions, you know, were, you know, to assure them they were loved and they were safe.
Mm-hmm.
Continue that same sort of stance, you know, in separation. You know, they need, the children need to know more than ever after separation that both parents love them. The situation is that the parents no longer love each other.
Mm-hmm.
But no matter what, the love for their children.
Continue that love.
Yes, as I say to my youngest daughter, this is not a question. Do I love you? This is not a question. This isn't a question.
Yep. Diana, you've been a fascinating guest, and we thank you for joining us on the program today to tell us your story, and hope that non-custodial parents, both fathers and mothers, gain some understanding from your experiences and how the family justice system is failing them and their children. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it from Dads in the Air this week. We hope you enjoyed the program, and I'd like to thank our special guest, Diana, for having the courage to tell us her story, which I'm sure will resonate with thousands of fathers out there who also have to deal with a similar situation on a daily basis. Don't forget, the program will be available on our website later today at www.dadsontheair.net. We look forward again to your company next week, when we'll have another interesting program for you.
We're dancing.